Welcome to Boston Basic Income. I'm Alex Howlett.
I'm Derek Van Gorder.
This week's topic is nominal GDP targeting, and we have monetary economist and economic historian George Selgin joining us to discuss. George Selgin is the director of the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute. He's written widely on the topics of monetary theory, monetary policy, and free banking. The concept of NGDP targeting is fairly straightforward, as esoteric as it may sound. In the economy, people are always buying stuff. Money flows in one direction while goods and services flow in the opposite direction. You spend your money to buy the economy's products. Nominal GDP is just a fancy way of saying the total amount of money being spent on products. Nominal GDP targeting, then, is a monetary policy of stabilizing that flow of spending. Conventional monetary policy, what we do now, on the other hand, is oriented around what's called inflation targeting. Instead of stabilizing spending alone, we try to keep the flow of money matched up with the flow of goods and services going in the other direction. In other words, we try to keep spending matched with economic output. This stabilizes the average price of consumer goods. If successful, reliably low and stable price inflation allows markets to set prices in dollar terms without having to worry about changes in the general purchasing power of the dollar. NGDP targeting is a proposed alternative to this status quo. By focusing only on the flow of money and ignoring the flow of output, NGDP targeting allows the purchasing power of the dollar to freely adjust in response to changes in the level of economic output. If there's less stuff to buy, then each individual dollar buys proportionally less. In preparation for today's discussion, we read a 2018 blog post by George entitled Some Serious Theoretical Writings That Favor NGDP Targeting, in which he surveys the perspectives of various different NGDP targeting proponents. Thanks for joining us here today, George. Personally, I'm not yet sold on the idea of NGDP targeting, but my mind is becoming more open to it, especially after some of our Twitter interactions. I'm also a regular listener of the Macro Musings podcast, and David Beckworth manages to weave NGDP targeting into nearly every episode, some kind of messaging about it. So the first question I want to ask is this: how does NGDP targeting compare to inflation targeting in facilitating the smooth operation of the economy?
Well, first of all, Alex, thanks for having me on the show. And hi, Derek. Thank you as well. I should say that you offered a very good summary in your opening remarks of NGDP targeting. So that's half the battle right there. You obviously know what it means. Now it's up to us to convince you that it's a good idea. I'll start, of course, by answering your question about stability. The basic idea of NGDP targeting, as you said, is that of targeting total spending. And the reason why it's a good idea, in my opinion and others' opinions, is that what it does is make sure that on the whole, industry producers are able to recoup their earnings, including a normal profit for successful ones. Of course, some may fail because they don't recoup, but then we hope others will have exceptional profits, so resources will move out of the failing firms into the more successful ones. But on the whole, industry is marching ahead. That can't happen if you have a collapse of spending, that is, receipts, revenues falling all around relative to total outlays in the past. That means that something's gone awry with the monetary system. Specifically, it's not supplying enough means of payment, and it's a shame, it's a waste of resources, it's a cause of unemployment. So we don't want that to happen. But we don't want spending to grow too rapidly either, because that can lead to problems. Inflation is one possible problem, depending on what output doing at the same time. And asset bubbles are also a problem, and they can be a problem even if general prices aren't rising, something maybe we can talk about later. Let me just add, a typical argument made for focusing on the general level of prices rather than on total spending as the object of stabilization is that when the general price level is either perfectly stable, zero inflation, or rising at a modest but steady pace, that allows relative prices to signal accurately changing relative demands for goods and services or changes in costs of different goods and services. And so we don't want people to have to sort out the difference between general price movements and movements of particular prices relative to others. And that's a sound argument, except when overall productivity is changing. The reason that that matters is because when overall productivity is growing, that means there's more output that's being produced per unit of factor input, of say combined aggregated factor input, land, labor, capital. Now we have an interesting situation, because that means that in equilibrium, there has to be some relative price changes. Specifically, the price of output as a whole needs to decline relative to the price of inputs if productivity is generally growing. And the opposite's true if productivity is not generally growing. Ah, well, now you see we have a little bit of a problem. Because when central banks stabilize inflation, what they call stabilizing the inflation rate is stabilizing the rate of change of output prices, usually consumer prices. That's what the CPI measures. It's what the PCE index measures. But as soon as we realize that doing that when productivity is growing rapidly or shrinking, we're destabilizing the factor price index. Because we know that one of them has to be moving to accommodate or to reflect productivity gains or losses, general one. That suddenly suggests that, after all, it isn't obvious in the face of productivity fluctuations that keeping the general output price or consumer price level stable or rising steadily is actually the way to keep the price system functioning smoothly and to minimize the difficulty people might have in understanding what price movements for individual goods signify. What I've argued at length is that, in fact, if you stabilize nominal income, which is kind of like stabilizing the input price level or its rate of change, that actually is, in the long run, more likely to be conducive to the overall clarity of price signals and therefore conducive to minimizing waste and avoiding fluctuations, macroeconomic fluctuations. Anyway, that was a long answer, Alex, but that is my answer to your first question.
I like the distinction that you're drawing between input prices or factor prices versus output prices, consumer prices. The question we can ask is, which one is it more useful to stabilize? But I have another question, which is, does stabilizing nominal income actually stabilize input prices? In a world where people are getting their money through jobs, then labor is an input. So in a way, you're stabilizing the price of labor. This is kind of where basic income comes into the equation a little bit, because in a basic income world, you can have wages fluctuate while total income, total consumer income, stays the same. Your nominal GDP target, if that's what you're doing in a basic income world, it's not necessarily stabilizing input prices, but it is still stabilizing that flow of consumer spending. Do you think that that's still a useful thing to do in that case?
Yes. Well, it turns out that there are a lot of debates, just as there are debates about whether we should be stabilizing nominal income or stabilizing the consumer price index. There are debates about whether we should be stabilizing all factor prices or an index of general factor prices or just an index of labor costs or wages. I should say wage rates to distinguish the level from the flow of wage payments. Now, I've written about this, and here's a way to think about it. Nominal GDP targeting could be made consistent with either of those two last choices, depending on how it's done. And here's the difference. If you're trying to stabilize the general level of factor prices or their growth rate, you would set an NGDP growth rate target that allowed NGDP to grow over time roughly at the rate of growth of total factor input. Now, you need an index. You need to weigh the different factor inputs. The good news is, maybe I should step back and explain, when a central bank is trying to stabilize the CPI inflation rate or PCE inflation rate, what it's actually trying to do is to gauge the growth of total output over time, as you implied in your opening remarks, and set the growth rate of nominal GDP to the growth rate of total output of final goods. So you could say that, therefore, targeting the CPI inflation rate or PCE inflation rate is a kind of nominal income targeting where the desired or planned rate of growth of nominal income is such as will match total output growth and keep prices from growing more than is desired. That makes sense, right, Alex? I'm asking you, but I hope your answer reflects what the audience also understands. So NGDP targeting can also be done by trying to get the growth of nominal income to match not total output growth, but only growth of factor inputs, labor and capital and land, if need be, weighted factor input. That lets the general level of prices fluctuate with productivity gains and losses, total factor productivity gains and losses, especially from things like technical innovations. Those would make inflation go down, harvest failures, wars would make it go up. Now, here's the thing. It's actually the productivity gains and losses or fluctuations in productivity growth that are the hardest to predict. So a central bank that's just trying to stabilize factor prices and set an NGDP growth rate to do so is more likely to get it right, because the least predictable component of total output growth is the total factor productivity level, which is hard to predict and which under a factor price stabilizing NGDP norm wouldn't have to be predicted.
Well, the total factor productivity is basically just a residual that
yes.
accounts for everything that you couldn't predict, right?
Exactly. That's right.
Okay.
And indeed, it fluctuates a lot. It's the biggest cause of fluctuations in total GDP. So we could expect a central bank to have a reasonably good forecast of future factor price input growth, to set an NGDP growth target according to that, plus its desired inflation rate, of course, long run inflation rate, and then let loose with that policy. And what we would see would be an inflation rate that varied over time, roughly as unpredictable total factor fluctuations occur.
So this is assuming you have some kind of model for what the real GDP growth is going to be, and you can kind of predict that a little bit, right?
Yes, a model as well as, of course, past information.
Right.
But again, it's important to realize that the challenge here is less than the challenge typical central banks are trying to meet today in predicting total output growth, because that's more variable, mainly because it includes the more volatile component of productivity change. So this is not a harder norm to implement or get right. It's actually an easier one. Now, if you were going to be concerned only with stabilizing an index of nominal wages, then of course you could do that with a nominal GDP rule that set the growth rate of nominal GDP equal to the expected rate of growth of labor input only, plus any long-run inflation target. All these things are possible, and I believe that either of those two factor price stabilizing NGDP target rules is better than the one that we currently implicitly have that's aimed at keeping the consumer price inflation rate roughly constant.
Okay, so a question we could ask is, would it be useful to have an NGDP target? That's harder to say than I thought it would be.
Sometimes I just say spending target, aggregate spending target, less of a tongue twister.
Yeah. So does it ever make sense to have an aggregate spending target that is not mapped onto factor prices? You just kind of keep the spending stable and let everything else do what it wants to do? Or is there going to be some kind of problem with that?
The problem is you've got to decide what kind of spending stability you want. You can't not choose. That is, do you want spending to be constant? Do you want it to grow at 2%, 3%, 5%? Do you want to occasionally change the target growth rate? You have to have some reasoning that allows you to decide which kind of NGDP target you want to achieve. The things we've been talking about are different options for doing that. Now, you can multiply these forever, I suppose, but I think that there's a lot of intuitive sense behind the case for stabilizing a general factor price index. There is somewhat less sense to setting the NGDP growth target so that you expect nominal wages to be stable on the whole. And there's the least intuitive and analytical basis for trying to keep the consumer price inflation rate stable by hook or by crook in a world of fluctuating inputs and productivity.
What about just keeping consumer spending stable regardless of price levels of either the factor prices or the output prices?
Well, you'd have to come up with an NGDP growth rate that wasn't consistent with either of those two goals.
Right.
I don't know why you'd want to do that. If you have an NGDP growth rate that doesn't stabilize factor prices, output prices, or input prices generally, or final goods prices, it's hard to see how anyone could defend that. What would be the advantage of that kind of NGDP targeting? Search me.
Yeah. So for me, the advantage would be that you wouldn't have to model these growth rates of factor prices, growth rates of productivity, or any of that.
That would be true only in the sense that if you use a dartboard to pick the NGDP growth rate, that spares you from having to model it.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that you've picked a very good growth rate. So maybe a little model, it makes sense.
What's wrong with a growth rate of zero?
There are arguments you could make for an NGDP growth rate of zero, but I don't think they'd hold up much. One obvious problem then is if NGDP doesn't grow and your labor force is growing, you're going to have nominal downward wage adjustments over time, and the nominal rigidities there are notorious. So that seems to me like a non-starter. While we could spare ourselves the need to think about what the right NGDP growth target should be, or to have to resort to any kind of modeling or reference to statistics of the past to tell us how the central bank should manage things to achieve a particular NGDP target, that would only be because we're not doing as much homework as we really need to do to make this alternative scheme work as well as possible. What I do want to insist on is we don't have to do any more work than central banks have to do to try and target a general price level.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. If you're only targeting the flow of money and you're not trying to match it perfectly against the flow of output, that seems like a much simpler problem to solve.
Yes, absolutely.
Maybe another more indirect way of getting at this question is, I remember in your article, you talked about how different supporters of NGDP targeting support it because by comparison, they feel that it does better for the welfare fundamentals, that was the phrase used in the paper, than other monetary targets. So I'm just sort of curious, what would you define as the welfare fundamentals of the economy? What's the underlying goal or underlying objective behind this target?
I think the best way to put it, Derek, is that the objective is to try to make the economy function to the fullest extent possible, as if every agent in the economy knew exactly what every equilibrium relative price was, and function as if every nominal price was exactly where it needed to be, or they collectively are all where they need to be to give you general equilibrium relative prices. So it's a knowledge criterion. You want to get as close to a fully informed economy as possible. In an economy like ours, in any market economy, a fully informed economy is one where the price signals are doing their job of accurately conveying information about relative scarcities in themselves, informed by special circumstances of supply and demand for different outputs in the economy and different inputs. So what we want to do is to get our economy to work like such an ideally fully informed economy. That translates into minimizing the noise in the price system. As I argue at length in my book, Less Than Zero, the best way to do that is to have a monetary policy that as much as possible avoids both nominal rigidities, that is, minimizes the circumstances in which it's necessary for rigid prices to have to be adjusted when maybe they won't be right away. But you also want to have a policy, ideally, that doesn't lend itself to confusion about what those price movements that do occur mean. I argue in that book at length that a nominal spending target is the best way to achieve both goals, particularly if it allows nominal spending to grow at a rate sufficient to absorb growth in factor inputs. And just to add one little tail to that typically long answer, let's keep in mind that factor input prices tend to be stickier than output prices, and particularly labor prices tend to be sticky. So the last prices we want to have to force to move around a lot are labor prices. And that's exactly what has to move in a inflation targeting setup when there are productivity changes.
So to kind of summarize that, you're saying that in a perfect world, all of the prices would just adjust instantaneously.
And everybody would know exactly what they mean.
Right. But the real world doesn't work like that. And there are certain prices that are stickier and more rigid than others. So what we can say is we can say, okay, we'll create a situation where those prices don't have to adjust and the other prices all adjust around them.
That's right.
So we don't have to put strain on those rigidities.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. And this is the so-called menu cost argument. And I give a lot of examples in my book of different circumstances where there are productivity changes, including, as is typically true, changes that are changes to different sectors of the economy where some goods and some sectors are becoming more and others less productive. You have those idiosyncratic productivity changes, but on top of those, you can also have overall productivity changes that mean more output on the whole or less. You want to have a policy norm that avoids having to change as much as possible the more rigid prices in the face of these combined idiosyncratic and general productivity innovations. And I show that except for the most artificial assumptions, NGDP targeting is almost always going to be better than inflation rate targeting at minimizing those menu costs.
Earlier in the discussion, you sort of paid lip service to the idea that people do intuit that inflation is a problem. It can be a problem in some situations. Why is it that NGDP targeting is being posited here as an alternative to inflation targeting, given that inflation targeting is said to create these unnecessary rigidities? Why wouldn't you say this would be an additional target and we should maybe relax the inflation target in certain scenarios, similar to how the Fed has recently announced it's thinking about relaxing its inflation target?
Well, unfortunately, the Fed's move to average inflation targeting doesn't at all address the problem of productivity innovations and how to best respond to those. If anything, the move to average inflation targeting from what was a kind of forward-looking inflation targeting, it creates a situation where the Fed's response to supply or productivity innovations is actually worse. It's actually worse. I talk about this in some blog post. As far as that change is concerned, we aren't moving in the right direction. Not to say average inflation targeting doesn't have some potential advantages, it does, but it doesn't have the advantages nominal income targeting would. As for inflation, let's be very clear. I just said today in a tweet that this is a hill I'm ready to die on. The hill is this: inflation and deflation. And we all, I think, understand that to mean general upward movements in consumer prices or downward movements in consumer prices, at least relative to some desired long-run target. Those things are not bad in themselves. They aren't the thing that we should care about. We should care about those types of changes in inflation only when they are not accurately signaling some underlying change in real circumstances that needs to be conveyed somehow through the price system. So let's take the case first, the more obvious one, and this is one that central bankers are more happy to concede. Let's assume you have a war or harvest failure. Well, all right then, general prices go up, and they should. And now think about what you have to do to prevent that. You have all this reduced output. The only way you're going to keep prices from rising in that case is by a pretty dramatic corresponding reduction in the money supply, such that nominal income itself collapses too. So now you have fewer goods and less money to buy the goods with. Is this making people better off? Not at all. First of all, you'll have rigidities. People will be very reluctant to take the necessary wage and salary cuts. Lawyers may have to get involved, et cetera, et cetera. Unemployment results in the short run. But also, since nominal spending is being contracted, it's impossible for firms to earn revenues that cover their historic costs. What do they do then? And what about debts? How do people pay their debts if their earnings are shrinking? It's a disaster. And as I said, many central bankers admit this. So what they essentially say is, okay, we'll back off on inflation targeting in the case of an adverse supply shock, major adverse supply shock. Great. But here's the problem. You can make similar arguments for the case of a big productivity gain, exceptional productivity growth. The same arguments that justify, rationalize allowing prices to rise with an adverse supply shock instead of shrinking earnings to prevent it. Also justify allowing prices to fall with productivity gains, exceptional productivity gains, if not predictable ones. All the arguments go through. Now, the consequences of preventing prices from falling in the case of productivity gains are admittedly not as obviously potentially drastic as in the opposite case, right? Because now what we're doing is having the central bank pump up spending to boost prices that otherwise would be sagging because there's a lot more goods being produced. And by the way, they're being produced at lower unit costs. And it's very painless for producers to cut prices when their unit costs of production are falling. They're trying to do it all the time. And we let individual ones like computer manufacturers, cell phone makers, we let them do it all the time. But we have this dumb theory that says, oh, you can't let that happen to goods in general if goods in general are getting cheaper. Yeah, why not? Why not? Anyway, it's not as if keeping general prices from falling in this kind of case is totally costless. In fact, it's just here where the problem of asset bubbles comes in. Because what are you doing? Well, consider you've got a case where your unit costs are falling. Now, if you just let prices fall to follow unit costs, as they would normally do and would do with a nominal GDP target, your firms are still making average profits. Their revenues, right, are covering their costs of production. It's just that they produce more efficiently, so they make those revenues with a greater output and sell each unit for less, as reflecting the fallen unit cost. Now, when the Fed or any central bank prevents that result, it's pumping up spending. And what that's going to do is to give firms earnings that exceed their outlays. It's going to generate a profit inflation. And in the short run, or for some time, this means all firms are scrambling for more resources. It means that they appear more profitable because they are in nominal terms. It means that if markets are efficient, asset prices go up, but eventually it translates into higher factor costs, like we were saying before, because that's how the real equilibrium has to work itself out in this case, higher nominal factor costs. Once that finally happens and the rigidities to wage rates, et cetera, are all overcome, those profits go away. That is, the average firm is now not any more profitable than before, which means that the firm isn't worth any more than before, which means its equity isn't worth as much as we thought it was, which means the bubble has to go away. It's going to crash.
So you're saying that in either the case of NGDP targeting or inflation targeting, the firm's real profits aren't going to go up. But in the case of inflation targeting, the nominal profits are going to go up. And during the transition, it'll look like the real profits are going up, and that'll inflate the stock price.
Well, I wouldn't even say that the real profits don't go up in the case of targeting. They go up temporarily. Accounting-wise, profit goes up.
I see.
The problem is that it's only a temporary boost in profit. In the end, it's going to go away, but it can inform asset price movements in the meantime if people don't realize that it's temporary. The point is, these bookkeeping profits are real enough, but they're also a will of the wisp, and that's what makes them dangerous. I'm not going to go out on a limb and say just how serious such unsustainable asset price movements can be. Obviously, it depends on just how rapidly nominal income is being allowed to grow to keep prices from falling. But why risk it? There's no reason. There's no reason. Let prices fall as goods get cheaper. And then the public knows what it means. They look around and say, oh, goods are cheaper today. Well, that means our economy is more productive. That's a clear signal. Why mess with it?
So in today's economy, the way we do monetary policy is through the central bank influencing interest rates and affecting the price of lending, et cetera, et cetera. So you're imagining that if we're propping up the price level during all of this, or we're propping up inflation during all of this, then that drives down interest rates as well, and that can help fuel asset price bubbles at the same time.
Yes, it's part of the same mechanism, and I'm glad you made the point, because the way the Fed, of course, boosts spending to prop up prices in the face of productivity growth is by setting a lower interest rate target, all other things equal, right? And so that lower interest rate target is informing profit signals, just as increasing firm revenues are doing the same. And this is just all good Vixellian economics, right? Except Vixell got it wrong. Vixell thought that if you stabilize the output price level, you're keeping interest rates at their natural level. His colleague David Davidson and some of the other Swedes said, no, Knut, you're wrong. It's the factor prices that need to be kept stable. They were right. They were right. Vixell, who I admire very much, blew it on this issue.
So this is interesting because basic income changes this picture a little bit. If we're funding consumer spending directly through the basic income, that allows the central bank to keep interest rates higher for the same inflation target. So I'm wondering if some of these problems are not necessarily due to inflation targeting or to propping up the price level, but due to the mechanism by which we do that, by keeping interest rates low. Does that make sense?
I think so, Alex. Let me put it this way. Suppose you had fiscal arrangements that kept nominal income growing at exactly the overall rate that we all decide is desirable for macro stabilization purposes. For argument's sake, let's say it's the rate that achieves a stable growth rate of a weighted index of factor prices. If that were being done, then the Fed could relax and just maintain things so that it doesn't screw that up. So there's nothing about NGDP targeting per se that says it has to be achieved entirely by monetary policy means and that fiscal policy has nothing to do with it, or vice versa. You know, whatever floats your boat, if you've got a stability of nominal income, the theories we've been discussing say that that'll be conducive to greater welfare and economic stability, however it's achieved. Now, obviously, some policies, some fiscal policies, for example, will have other implications. We can't just assess them on macroeconomic grounds. That's a different question. But as far as the macro territory that we're immediately concerned with here, it's fine to achieve the requisite stability by fiscal means.
Yeah, I like that you generalize to fiscal means in general, because it doesn't have to be a basic income.
That's right. No.
The government could be spending money.
Tax and spending policies generally, of course, and borrowing.
Right. So Bethany asked a question in the chat. She says, Alex, are you suggesting that in a basic income world, the basic income would fluctuate to complement changes in wage levels? Sort of. I'm more suggesting that as we get more productive with our labor and wages go down, basic income can make up the gap in consumer spending power. Now, if we're doing an NGDP level target where we're trying to keep wages stable, then obviously that wouldn't happen. I suppose the basic income could pay for the additional output that the economy could produce with what it's spending on its labor or something like that.
Then you'd be stabilizing the price level all over again using fiscal policy to make up for the monetary authorities don't do, but there's no need. Your workers are earning a stable wage rate. It's distinguished between the wages and wage rate, but it's helping them to do that for total wages and total spending to be stabilized. As they become productive, as the economy becomes productive under a nominal spending rule, prices of goods and services are falling, and real wages are thereby ratcheting up in step with productivity growth through that mechanism. There's no need for the nominal wages to keep up.
Is there then an assumption there that every household is going to be able to have a wage? Like, what if it ends up being the case that the most efficient labor market has some people working a lot and some people not working at all? Then you'd have some consumers left without income to spend on the economy's output. Does that make sense?
Of course it makes sense, and it's possible, but nobody's advocating that. I wouldn't advocate that.
I advocate that. So at least one person is advocating that.
Okay, well, I would think that some people have to, I would think that the people, though, who aren't employed in that circumstance should get income by some other means, that we have to have some kind of welfare system for them. And if we do, then that source of income has to be reckoned as part of the overall income that you're trying to stabilize. I mean, NGDP targeting doesn't imply any particular policy about who gets the nominal income. The fiscal authorities are free to play with that any way they like. And those of us who are proposing NGDP targeting for that reason, we're able to be perfectly agnostic about it. So it's not the case that having a policy of nominal GDP targeting means leaving anybody behind as far as income is concerned. Policies like the kind you're advocating, although on a national scale and not necessarily done by the feds, but a national scale, would simply be part of the information about total income that is relevant to achieving the aggregate target. But this targeting is a macroeconomic policy. It's not a substitute for microeconomic policy. It's not a substitute for income redistribution. It's not a substitute for basic welfare. It doesn't do any of those things, but it doesn't prevent any of those things.
I appreciate that you're drawing a box around what you think this target solves and leaving room, leaving space for other policy debates about what kind of fiscal policies are ideal.
It certainly is not a solution to relative poverty.
Yeah.
It doesn't guarantee by itself that there won't be people who are in need of support.
Yeah.
The spending will be out there. You just got to move it around a little bit. If the spending isn't out there at all, good luck.
Right. Well, there'll be different debates about how best to do that.
Yes, of course.
There is a question Neil wrote in the chat that I wanted to get your thoughts on because it relates more to this idea of NGP targeting versus stabilizing the price level. He says, in the present environment, we have more productive capacity than we could use with the present economic situation, so we can increase the amount of goods without prices moving. If the price level drops, we can get into a liquidity trap where people postpone buying because the price will be lower in the future. What do you, in general, do you think of the argument or the concern that falling prices actually cause people to spend less?
Well, it's not true, first of all, for good reason. Eventually, people get hungry, who want to go out and buy something and eat. We had deflation, mild deflation. And by the way, deflation not that far off from the rate of productivity growth, that is, minus the rate of productivity growth. For most of the period between 1876 or 5 until 1896 or 7, prices fell pretty much every year, a couple percentage points thereabouts. Obviously, people didn't stop spending, or we'd know it. They spent because although prices might be going down again further in the future, they don't want to put off consumption and enjoyment and gaining satisfaction by spending money forever, because satisfaction put off isn't worth as much as satisfaction now. And so it's a non-problem. It's an interesting case of a non-problem that has persisted in being perceived as a problem, but there's no real basis for it.
Yeah, it didn't result in a kind of deflationary spiral or anything like that.
Yeah, no, nothing of the sort. Because as I said, if people, other things equal, they value having their goodies sooner rather than later, not all at once necessarily, of course, but that means that there's always something that they are happy to be spending on at any time.
Yeah.
Even if prices are falling.
So I think we all agree that the stable purchasing power of money is what allows us to use it as our pricing and payments standard in the first place. And if economic output is fairly stable, real economic output is fairly stable on its own, then NGDP targeting automatically gives us fairly stable average consumer prices anyway, right? You don't have to worry about that too much.
Yeah, they're the same. In that case, in the case of stable productivity growth, stabilizing NGDP and stabilizing CPI growth rate or PCE index rate of change, they all amount to the same thing. The only interesting case, the only time it matters that we should debate these options is because of productivity changes. Then we need to ask, in that case, if productivity is generally changing, what kind of stability do we need? We've argued already a little bit here that it isn't stability of the PCI in that case that matters most. It is stability of spending, which means greater stability of factor prices rather than output prices. So speaking about the desirability of a stable purchasing power of money is a little bit misleading. There's a risk there of latching on to the wrong ideal because there's a better one in the case where productivity is fluctuating.
Well, I'm still personally latched on to the wrong ideal, but maybe I'll get to the better one at some point. This reminds me of a point that comes up often in the basic income discussion, where if we get hit by an asteroid and the economy's productive capacity gets cut in half, what do we do with the basic income? Do we cut the basic income in half, or do we allow the price level to rise until the purchasing power of the basic income is half of what it used to be? And I think this is related to the NGDP issue.
Absolutely related, yeah. May I answer that?
Yeah.
Let's just make it easy analytically by assuming that the only source of nominal income is basic income. That's what people earn. For some reason, nobody's earning anything else. But assume that they also contract debts and so on. Assume that factories are going, but they're all run by machines, which is conceivable. We still would have reason to want people's nominal earnings to be fairly stable for allowing them to pay their debts, etc. Whereas if we cut those earnings drastically...
Let's call it income, not earnings, because you don't really earn the basic income.
Earnings, income, entitlements, what have you. If we cut them, we're adding insult to injury because people are already, of course, worse off. They're bound to be because of the asteroid and the damage that it does. But if they have any outstanding debts, any obligations that they depended on a steady earnings to meet, now they're going to be hurt by an inability to do that. Thus, just doesn't make any sense. By the way, I think the point I'm making is exactly what policymakers implicitly had in mind in dealing with the COVID crisis, right? They could have just said, well, you know, there's less output, et cetera, so some people are getting fired. But they didn't. They not only tried to compensate for the loss of earnings that those people incurred, but they tried to do it in a way that would maintain aggregate earnings, or at least go far in that direction. And I think that was the right thing to do.
That makes sense.
That makes sense to me. But then also, Alex and I are coming at this from kind of a different perspective. And I think maybe the reason why, at least I'm kind of attracted to still talking about an inflation target, is Alex and I both have the intuition that we're not really maximizing the efficiency or the extent of spending. Like, we're able to do a lot of these fiscal infusions now because we're not at the maximum level. But then Alex and I have policy ideas about actually trying to, how do we make sure the economy is running at its maximum spending potential at all times? And once you're there, we kind of have to know, well, okay, something has to signal to us that we're finding those limits. So I guess I'm just curious to hear from you, like, if you imagine a scenario where we're really bringing the economy to its full potential, why wouldn't inflation be a good way to know when we somehow have to put the brakes on, when there's just no more real benefit we're going to get out of it?
And just to tack on to that, if our economy had been producing at full capacity, kind of maxed out when COVID hit, then we wouldn't have been able to respond to COVID with stimulus, with demand stimulus, because we would have had just the negative supply shock and our demand would have already been maxed out, right?
Well, look, I mean, if the goal is to keep demand stable, that's nominal spending. Targeting anything that involves allowing total spending on final goods and services to fluctuate is ipso facto destabilizing aggregate demand. They're the same thing. They're just two names for the same thing. That's why I find it odd that, for example, Keynesians, advocates of policies to stabilize aggregate demand, they talk about it in those terms. Don't all jump on the NGDP bandwagon. And in fact, if you read Keynes's general theory, he came within an ace of doing so. He's got several pages where he says, well, what we really should be targeting is the wage index, nominal wage. But then all of a sudden, he just caves in. You know, so at the time when price level stabilization was just gaining popularity with Fisher and Castell. So at some point, the general theory, he caves in, he abandons all the theoretical considerations that were leaning him in the other direction, and embraces what we today call price level targeting, output price level targeting. But demand stability, aggregate demand stability, is what you want. It's what NGDP achieves. I have to say, I think it's kind of funny to be talking to basic income guys who would keep the general price level stable, even if that meant cutting people's nominal earnings, because that's the last thing you want to do. That would be in the case of an adverse supply shock, right? The other case is a little trickier of why we would let the inflation rate fall for positive supply shock. But there are reasons for that too, as I explained.
Yeah, I like the idea of cutting nominal earnings, because if you divide consumer income into like the earnings people get from wages and then the basic income, the lower the wages, the higher the basic income. So the higher proportion of people's income is not tied to a job.
But you just said yourself that those aren't earnings, they're just income.
Right.
Why would you prefer having people get their income without helping to produce stuff for the rest of us, as opposed to getting it by producing stuff for the rest of us?
Yeah.
Obviously, if everyone is relying on basic income and not on other income, we can follow through your argument to its reductio ad absurdum. We're all getting basic income and no one's making anything at all, and we're all worse off. So I would say no, the argument should be, let's try to keep people earning their income productively as much as possible and not embrace policies that would cut their earnings from normal activity just so we can give them more basic income.
Yeah, so that's the question, right? That's the big question that everybody asks.
Why would you want to do that?
Right. The answer that I have is that if we are creating jobs, supporting people's earnings, their wages, as a way of getting the money, then by definition, it's not productive. We're employing people unproductively.
Why?
Because
compared to giving them money?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So they don't go to work and you get them a check and they just go shopping. That's all they do. That's going to be better and more productive than if they earn a paycheck by going to work and helping them make stuff?
Well, it's the difference between paying people to be unproductive, forcing them to be unproductive so they can earn a living, versus giving them the freedom to spend their time how they want.
Why are you calling people who work unproductive?
Because we're using monetary policy to create full employment.
No, he's talking
about a scenario where instead of letting markets determine employment, we're actually using policy to create employment.
This is allowing markets to work. Don't look at it as a central bank making people work. Think of it as a central bank doing what we've created, a central bank to supply us with money, for better or for worse. I don't like it, but there it is. So what we want that central bank to do is not, we don't want it to fuck up the market, okay? Now, how does a central bank not, I see nominal GDP targeting as a rule for keeping the central bank from fucking up how the market works. That's why I talked about a perfect information ideal, overcoming nominal rigidities. This is all about letting markets function efficiently. It's not about somehow making people work who don't want to. It's not about getting them to go into factories that we don't need, that aren't making anything of any value. Most factories make something that's worth something and so on. This isn't wasteful. And even if it were somewhat wasteful for people to be going to work to get their pay, it couldn't be any worse than them doing nothing to get their pay. And if everyone, as I said before, did nothing to get their pay, they just come to the basic income store or whatever you call it and get their checks. There ain't nothing to buy with those checks. Somebody's got to make stuff somewhere.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think we all agree that we want markets to be efficient, minimal interference from the central bank and government institutions, all of that. And you need someone to make the stuff. So we need the incentives to be such in the labor market that enough labor gets contributed to produce the stuff that people want to buy. The question is, what level of basic income is compatible with that? Is it zero? Maybe you would think that it's zero and you want to get people money through jobs as much as possible. But I would say that as soon as you start using economic policy to boost wages or employment, then you are interfering with the labor market. You are distorting the labor market away from efficiency.
You're not doing that, Alex, if all you're doing is making sure that the flow of spending doesn't collapse now and then, all right? I mean, we're not starting from zero and then creating all this artificial spending stuff. All we're doing is asking the central bank to not let spending collapse. And we have to have, as you just said, a criterion of what it means for the central bank to not interfere. We have to define what that means. And I'm telling you, what it means to me and David Beckworth and other proponents of nominal GDP targeting is that the central bank manages things to maintain a steady and usually steadily growing level of overall spending in the economy. None of this in equilibrium is creating any false jobs. It's not like real wages are determined by this policy or boosted up. The real wage rate is determined by the productivity of the economy, nothing else, the productivity of labor specifically. The nominal GDP target is designed to avoid having monetary policy influence real returns, real wages, so that the economy hires people when there's an efficiency basis for it. Now, basic income is a different thing. Basic income, we shouldn't confuse these two. My understanding is basic income is what we do to make sure that no one is left behind, that no one for any reason is not sharing in whatever the total amount of nominal spending is going on, is not getting part of it, and therefore is unable to, maybe able to survive somehow, but not able to prosper at all. So the basic income formulas step in, make sure those people get enough, presumably by getting funds from elsewhere. The monetary authorities just see to it that the total amount of spending is stable. I don't think basic income can or should attempt to be a substitute for having monetary and fiscal authorities make sure between them that total spending grows steadily. I think someone has to do that. I don't think basic income is a good policy for that, precisely because it should only be to make sure nobody gets left behind. It shouldn't be a substitute for people going and seeking jobs and going to work and all that.
I think that's fair enough. We do think about basic income a little bit differently on this podcast. I tend to think about basic income as the default way that people get their money. And then in order to create an incentive for people to work, you reduce the basic income to a level that gets the labor market working efficiently.
Just to couch that from a different perspective, because Alex tends to think of the world from after that's in place, we would say that while we would hope that basic income is enough to, you know, erase poverty, make sure that people are not left behind or not abjectly poor, we would hope that to be the case. I think generally speaking, people on this podcast try to look at basic income from a macroeconomic perspective and sort of wonder, well, what amount is optimal? We don't want to overshoot the optimal amount and therefore remove necessary labor incentive, but we don't necessarily want to undershoot the amount and then people are unnecessarily poor and the economy has less consumer spending than it could otherwise sustain.
Or unnecessarily working.
So we see basic income as a way of maybe addressing that problem.
Those questions are not questions about aggregate incomes. Those are questions about individual earning. And you're going to have to fine tune that for every person. And of course, that's what's happening when you conceive of it as a redistribution scheme. You're getting funds from some people, presumably better off people, and you're making them available to others who you feel don't have what you consider a basic income level. But it wouldn't make much sense, in my opinion, to have this policy somehow be a substitute where we figure out the total amount of income that we want, and then we figure out how to divide it among all the different people, and then we make sure that we gather it up again and spend it all again or give it back to them again and so on. regardless of what they've been up to, which kind of begs the question, how do you get the money back again? But in any event, that seems to me like a very cumbersome thing. And moreover, I would say it seems to me something that couldn't possibly be consistent with having a market economy at all.
But all right,
that's just my way of looking at it, to the limited extent that I understand it.
All right, fantastic. Well, maybe I'll send you a couple of resources and get your thoughts after this.
We'll have a race to see whether you win me over to basic income before I win you over to nominal income targeting. How's that?
That's a tough one. You might win that one. I'm not sure.
Well, that's not only be because I'm a hard case, Alex, and you're a flexible sort of guy.
Well, it's been a real treat to have you here with us today, George. Thanks so much. As you know, I remain somewhat skeptical of NGDP targeting, primarily because I feel so strongly about the stability of consumer prices as being kind of fundamental to the nature of money. But if you're keeping income stable, it's hard for consumer prices to fluctuate wildly anyway, unless something else bad is going on. So we'll see. I'll keep an open mind. And next week's topic, we're talking about modern money. We'll be digging into Randall Ray's take on MMT, and MMT proponents James Keenan and Adam Rice will join us to discuss.
Sounds fun. I'll tune in. Thank you both very much for this. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Great to have you on.
Okay. Bye-bye.